Welcome to the Bible's Greatest Mysteries from Skywatch TV. I'm Derek Gilbert.
I am Sharon Gilbert, and as you can see, we actually have three chairs on the set now. Thank you, Cherise Parton, for taking care of that, because we have a special guest, and both of us get to interview him.
Oh, yes. This is really exciting, because this is a program. We're beginning a series of programs this week that focus on evidence of one of the most spectacular stories in the Bible, or series of stories in the Bible. And this is going to cause waves in the academic community, but will really be a blessing to you and to your children and grandchildren as we see evidence for some of the foundational stories in the history of Israel and, of course, by extension, for us as Christians.
These are stories that every one of your kids and grandkids know. You learned them when you were growing up in Sunday school, but we're going to find out all of the details and the truth that proves the Bible is true.
Yes. Well, of course, we need to go into the bag and get our assignments this
week. I know.
Let's find out,
because we don't even know the name of our guest who's sitting right here, do we? Actually, we do.
Yes. I'm going to need your help in pronouncing this. You founded a seminary in
Akadem Garadok, which means academic city in Russian.
Okay.
And served there for 10 years. He's also a Bachelor of Arts in Evangelism, Master of Divinity, Master of Theology, Master of Arts, and a PhD from the University of Toronto in 2016. Yes. In other words, a credentialed scholar. And we're going to be talking for the next few weeks about his brand new book, Origins of the Hebrews, and trust me, this will set off shockwaves. It is our honor to welcome Dr. Doug Petrovich to the Bible's Greatest Mysteries. Doug, thank you for joining us.
I'll shake your hand. I'm right here.
It's good to be with you.
I'll shake your hand because I shook his hand.
Yes. So this is the origins of the Hebrews, the story of the Israelites' sojourn in Egypt. What is the significance of that story?
Well, that story essentially is the foundation for the Hebrew people, for the Jewish people of all time until our day. There's no story that's as critical to them and their personal, individual, and corporate history than the story of the Exodus from Egypt, because they were there for 430 years, according to Exodus 12, 40, and 41. And with that long period of time that they were there, there should be evidence that they were indeed there. So what God allowed me the opportunity was to kind of fall into some of this evidence and then just keep following the trail as an archaeologist and an epigrapher, which is someone who deals with ancient inscriptions, deciphering them and translating them. And Middle Egyptian language, and of course that's a form of hieroglyphics, mm-hmm. and actually Middle and Late Egyptian, that's the focus of the first minor of my PhD.
Oh, that's interesting.
So the foundational history of Israel and the giving of the law to Moses, mm-hmm. all of that kind of relates to the subject of your book, just the evidence that, yes, we actually do see traces of the Israelite presence in Egypt. Why is it then that here we are in the 21st century with archaeologists who've been digging stuff out of the sand since the 19th century, when this fascination with Egypt really began? I mean, Sharon's been researching this for her series of novels set in the Victorian era. Mm-hmm. There was a fascination with what was happening in Egypt.
Oh, yeah.
But yet we've been told for more than 100 years, no evidence for the Israelites in Egypt at all, that they never did. We're never there. The whole story was just made up. Why have archaeologists not seen this evidence till now?
Well, there's a number of reasons behind that. Part of it being many archaeologists are not interested in seeing an actual physical, verifiable connection between the ancient Israelites and the Egyptians at this time. That's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Another part of it is among the Christian evangelical scholars who have training in Egyptology, and there are very few of us out there who actually have credentialed training in Egyptology, but among the few that are out there, almost all of them subscribe to what's called the late Exodus view, and that basically kind of you can connect it with Cecil B. DeMille's Ten Commandments and Disney's Prince of Egypt, right?
Because we all know Yul Brynner was the Pharaoh of the Exodus.
Exactly. Yeah. And they call him Ramses.
Right.
So that connects people with the 13th century BC, which is the 1200s BC, right?
Uh-huh. Right.
But the problem is careful treatment of biblical chronology doesn't land you at the time of the Exodus in the 13th century BC. It lands you in the middle of the 15th century BC, which is around 200 years earlier. So with the Egyptologists who are trained evangelicals in this field, they're looking for evidence that will connect Israelites to Egypt in this Exodus era in the wrong time period. Mm. And if you're looking in the wrong time period, you're not going to find any of the connections that are there. You've got to match, to
you're
synchronize
in the
perfectly.
Wrong place,
I was thinking
Indiana,
that very
yes,
thing,
exactly.
Yes, Sala in Indiana Jones, and you're looking in the wrong place.
Yeah.
But there's a big debate about that, this 200-year or so discrepancy between timelines.
Yeah, and it essentially goes back to this. There is an archaeologist of the 20th century named William Albright, and he's the one who pretty much propagated this and made famous and developed a lot of followers who would agree with him that the late Exodus view is right. And and the thing was, he was basing it on archaeology, not on the Bible itself. And he was looking at the archaeological record and saying, we have no evidence of Israelites from 1400 B.C. to 1200 B.C. In the land. So because we have no evidence of them there, it must be the case that that's the wrong timing for the Exodus itself.
So was it not there, or was it interpreted incorrectly?
Well, here's the thing. When the Israelites first settled into the land of Canaan, they didn't go into the cities like God intended them to, right? What he was going to do is allow them to exterminate all of the Canaanite people who had sinned so grievously that, God had enough and they needed to be dealt with as such. But what he was going to do is give them cities that they didn't build themselves.
Right.
But they were used to being nomadic. They had 40 years wandering in the desert, so they were used to a nomadic lifestyle, not living in homes. So what they did when they moved into the land, they went into the hill country and essentially were semi-nomadic. They were living in tents. They were not living in cities. So there's really no expectation, or should not be any expectation, that we would see in the archaeological record that they're there from 1400 to 1200. We would expect this. So that's not a good reason to say that there couldn't be an Exodus in the middle of 15th century.
And because Egypt was essentially defeated very, very embarrassingly by all of this, they probably wouldn't have written it down either.
No.
Hey, we got beaten really bad by the God of these people. No. Our slaves, we gave them a bunch of gold and sent them off on their way.
Yeah. And there's a famous Egyptologist of our day named Kenneth Kitchen, and he's proven that the Egyptians didn't record their defeats. But occasionally, not very often, but occasionally you'll see the ancient people that defeated them recording it in their texts, but the Egyptians do not. So it's no surprise at all that the account of the Exodus doesn't show up, because that was a catastrophic defeat.
So, kind of like modern-day news. You don't, when your political party, for example, makes a mistake,
sweep it under the rug.
Right.
So what is the evidence that you begin to find?
Oh, boy. I'll tell you where it all started. It all started, I was supposed to be finishing my Ph.D., writing my dissertation. But in the midst of looking for texts to read and study to prepare for my comprehensive exam, I stumbled across information of animal burials at the right site where the Israelites lived. It's called Ancient Avaris, that we connect to biblical Ramses, which is a later toponym.
The toponym being a place name.
A place name where later it was called that. But at the time Moses wrote, he would have written something differently, and that it was updated. A scribe would have updated it.
So the animal burials, what was interesting about those?
So it's at the right place, the right site at Avaris, where Jacob settled, and it's at the right time period, because these animal burials date to the reign of Amenhotep II. Who is he? Well, in a 2006 journal, a peer-reviewed journal article that I published, I made the case that there's only one pharaoh who matches all of the biographical requirements of the Exodus pharaoh, if you take all of those things seriously and literally, they're recorded in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
He can't be the firstborn. His firstborn can't be on the throne because he dies in the 10th
plague. Both of them would have been dead then.
Right, they would both die in the 10th plague. And all of the other requirements. He, Amenhotep II, is the only pharaoh who meets these requirements. So the scant evidence from pottery that is found in these animal burials dates to his reign. Now, what about the burials? That's the important part.
Right.
There are four animals that were buried, and we're not talking about the residential district at Avaris where the people lived, but the palatial district where there were three palaces. in that area of all places. There were burials of four types of animals. The very four types of animals we read about in Exodus 11 and 12, right before and at the time of the first Passover. Four animals: dogs, cattle, sheep, and goats. Hmm. And the majority of the burials are mass burials, not just one animal, but multiple animals. And the majority of the animal burials are sheep and goats. And the majority of the sheep and goats, guess what, are in their first year of age.
Oh, okay.
And of course, the sacrificial animals
right.
that the Israelites are supposed to provide, remember, to get the blood to put on the lentils and the doorposts, they're supposed to be in their first year of age. In our English Bibles, often it reads maybe not perfectly where it says they were one-year-olds, but they weren't one-year-olds. They were less than one-year-olds. It's the Hebrew term ben shana, which is son of a year, so less than a year.
Okay.
And that's exactly what the archaeological record provides.
You're talking about an area that you're referring to as Avaris, but our Bible says Goshen.
Well, Goshen would be the general region.
Okay.
Kind of like a state. Or a, or a county.
Okay.
But the city itself was called Avaris in a more ancient time. But actually, at the time of Moses' life, it had changed from Avaris to Perunefer, which is an Egyptian term that means pleasant journey, which is perfect. It fits the city because it's where traffic goes into from the rest of the world and goes out of Egypt. So it's a perfect launching point, whether by sea or by land.
So it was a contact point between Egypt and the Levant, meaning Canaan, and then on to Mesopotamia. Yeah.
And Africa and Asia.
So a trading center.
Yeah, the perfect site. Wouldn't you know God would put them in the most ideal place in the ancient world?
That is so interesting, because Derek and I have talked many times about the notion that these tent dwellers weren't really, they weren't considered clean or nice or you don't want to hang out with them. They were the Egyptians were very prejudiced toward these people as time went by. So they didn't want to commingle with them. But the irony there is that the Lord allowed that so that they could live a pure existence in an area that was, as you say, a source of trade. It actually allowed them to flourish.
Sure.
Well, we'll talk about that as we discuss the evidence for the origins of the Hebrews, the new book by Dr. Douglas Petrovich. We've talked a little bit about Avaris, the city that was occupied by the Hebrews in the time of Moses. But what evidence is there of the previous 430 years leading up to the Exodus? The Bible's greatest mysteries continues after this.
Get the groundbreaking new book by Dr. Douglas Petrovich, Origins of the Hebrews, for your gift of $50 plus shipping and handling. Call toll-free 1-844-750-4985 or log on to skywatchtvstore.com.
Call now and take advantage of Skywatch TV's most groundbreaking deal of the year. With the rediscovery of the ancient prophecies from a mysterious group of prophets and scribes hundreds of years before Christ, your understanding of end times prophecy and the final age of man is about to be forever changed. In Josh Peck's new book, The Lost Prophecies of Qumran, the veil is lifted as you discover how much of what you've been taught about Israel in the first century is incomplete. Shockingly, there were Jewish believers who knew exactly what to expect from the coming Messiah, that he would be God in the flesh, would die for our sins, and even the date of his first arrival. In Josh Peck's new book, The Lost Prophecies of Qumran, you will discover lost prophecies only recently discovered in the Dead Sea Scrolls about the time we are now living in, how the enigmatic group known as the Essenes formed and what influence they had on the New Testament, what hidden feasts and festivals the Essenes celebrated, and what messages the group left behind for believers living in the present age, how the prophecies of Daniel and Revelation fit within the Essene timetable, and how an ancient Jewish calendar actually predicts the prophetic significance of the year 2025. But that's not all. For the first time ever, you'll also receive Dr. Ken Johnson's massive three-book collection entitled The Ancient Mysteries of the Essenes, where Dr. Johnson compiles three of his most groundbreaking research studies on the Dead Sea Scrolls into one massive collection. In Book 1, The Ancient Dead Sea Scrolls Calendar and the Prophecies It Reveals, you will discover the secrets of the mysterious 364-day calendar used by the ancients since the time of creation and how it has been hidden until now for the appointed time. In Book 2, Ancient Testimonies of the Patriarchs, Autobiographies from the Dead Sea Scrolls, you will hear the previously hidden prophetic texts of such patriarchs as Enos, grandson of Adam, Lamech, father of Noah, Amram, father of Moses and Aaron, and even Enoch from the Book of Enoch fame. And in the most shocking revelation yet, Book 3, The Ancient Order of Melchizedek, you will learn astonishing facts about the enigmatic priest Melchizedek, such as why his priesthood was and is different from that of Levi, why the Messiah was ordained after the order of Melchizedek, and how the facts surrounding this mysterious order dramatically affect the theology and practical applications of our Christian walk today. This collection is an absolute necessity for any researcher's library and for those who want to fully step into the minds of the ancients and see the Dead Sea Scrolls like they never have before. Now you can get this incredible collection for your donation of only $35 plus shipping and handling. So don't miss out on SkyWatch TV's most groundbreaking deal of the year, the Lost Prophecies and Ancient Mysteries Collection, available now at SkyWatchTVStore.com. Order now or call 1-844-750-4985.
Welcome back to the Bible's Greatest Mysteries from SkyWatch TV. I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert, and we are delighted to be here with our guest, Dr. Doug Petrovich, and he is telling us all about the Hebrews in Egypt.
Avaris, the city that was sort of that port with international connections for trade and exchange of other ideas like religion and literature and so forth, that was the point from which the Hebrews left during the Exodus. But if that's true, then there would be evidence of their occupation there leading up to that point. So what about the evidence of their occupation down from, say, the time of Joseph?
Sure. And I wrote a journal article on the evidence for Israelites at the time of the Exodus based on these animal finds and several other finds that are recorded in my book. And at that point, it was rejected by a secular journal. And the chief editor wrote me back. It's in the UK. He wrote me back and he said, I'm not rejecting this for the scholarship. In other words, it's not bad scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm rejecting it because you can't connect events from the 15th century BC to a book that was written 1,000 years later. And he was referring to the Bible, of course.
The assumption being that the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures, were written by scholars in Babylon.
Even though your scholarship was worthy of printing?
Right. Yes. So, once that was rejected, someone suggested to me, he said, Doug, you need to write this in a book. And I said, you know, maybe that's a great idea. Because if you research and have enough for an entire book, then you can make sure that somebody will publish it and you're not just going to be rejected, mm-hmm. you know, by your peers. So that's what I did. And I decided at that point, I need to research and find if there's more evidence. Because if I found evidence of the time of the Exodus itself and the 10th plague, then there has to be evidence that they were there for 430 years. You would think there would be evidence somewhere. So I just prayed and I got busy in my research and I went through all the books and the journal articles and I, all of a sudden, as I like to term it, I stumbled into one gold mine after another. And the first one being evidence to identify in Middle Egyptian hieroglyphic inscriptions four biblical characters, Joseph, Ephraim, his son, who had the position of honor, mm-hmm. Manasseh, his oldest son, Manasseh's grandson, an obscure name in the Bible recorded only once in Joshua 17, named Shechem. And almost certainly also, those all are certain, and almost certainly as well, Jacob. So that's the evidence that I first came to identify that they were there much earlier than the 15th century BC.
With scholars then saying that there's no evidence here, how is it that you located these? These clearly were not written then in Hebrew. Otherwise, Hebrew scholars of years past would have stumbled onto this long ago.
Mm-hmm.
How did you interpret or decipher these texts to identify these characters?
Most of them were already deciphered, and Egyptologists published on them. One of them was only partially translated, and that's an inscription called Sinai 115, which is recorded in detail in my first book, The World's Oldest Alphabet, which connects the oldest alphabetic script in the history of the world with the Hebrews. And that inscription, only the beginning of it was translated, the beginning of the caption, because there's the picture underneath of a man sitting on a donkey, and that's his name is Chebeded in Egyptian, and that means he who was disfavored, whom I connect to Manasseh. And the boy in front of him, the boy in front of him on the donkey, his name in a different caption is Shechem, which is the Egyptian equivalent of Shechem, the son, one of the six sons the Bible records as the children, the sons of Manasseh.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
So, now, did the Hebrews who were living in Egypt at the time have a scribal class? Did they write?
Well, the Egyptians had a scribal class, mm-hmm. just like the Mesopotamians who wrote in cuneiform. And with hieroglyphic Egyptian, you had to be point on with every glyph that you inscribe. It's pristine. It's accurate beyond measure in almost every inscription. But there are Middle Egyptian inscriptions at a site down in Sinai called Sirabit el-Khadim, and that's where the Egyptian teams would go, conceivably once a year, but many years they wouldn't go. But so it's a roughly annual expedition down to extract turquoise from the mines that are there. And it's there where we see these inscriptions that are written in a form of hieroglyphs that's not as pristine, that's a little bit of a, kind of like a layman's version.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And these are written by this guy named Chebeded, who names himself, he gives his own title, he names his son, and these expeditions are connected to Avaris. That's the place from which they were launched. And that makes perfect sense that he would be on a donkey as an Asiatic, mm-hmm. right? Because the Egyptians, didn't prefer donkeys. And sure enough, the same time period at Avaris, where we have burials for the second Asiatic occupational phase there, guess what's buried along with the people who have the most grave goods among the Asiatics?
Well, donkeys.
Donkeys.
Uh-huh.
Which is very common among the Amorites, who dominated the culture of mm-hmm. Canaan and
exactly.
Mesopotamia at
mm-hmm.
the time.
Mm-hmm.
But and we should point out Chebeded, then this name, mm-hmm. he who was disfavored. If you remember the story of Joseph bringing his sons Ephraim and Manasseh to Jacob for blessing, Jacob reversed his hands and blessed the younger son mm-hmm. Ephraim above and gave him the birthright.
Right.
So Manasseh, who should have had mm-hmm. the birthright of the elder, was disfavored.
Favor was taken away from him.
And his son Shechem, named for the city where their sister,
exactly,
or
yes,
their aunt mm-hmm. Dinah, was violated by Shechem, who was the son of Hamor, the king of mm-hmm. Shechem. Mm-hmm. So, wow,
the connections are amazing.
Now, I've looked at the inscriptions, and we'll use some of the images from your book to help illustrate this. Mm-hmm. But the clothing mm-hmm. on that inscription, showing the manner of dress of Chebeded and Shechem, how is that distinctive?
Well, if you look, there's one image that's in my book of an Asiatic man. There were fragments of a statue that were found in various places at Avaris, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even different occupational phases, fragments were found. So they kind of just were laying around for a while, and all of a sudden they got buried in a later phase, that kind of thing. There's a headpiece, there's a shoulder piece, there's part of a foot, and there are other pieces. And with those pieces, there are enough of the fragments, there's enough to reconstruct what this individual would have looked like. And he was wearing a multicolored robe and
a coat of many colors.
Yes. And there's enough actual paint that survived that we know it's red and black and white, right?
Huh.
And so that is, the question then is, who is the person behind this statue? Other scholars out there have suggested that this is Joseph, but it's not Joseph, which I prove in my book.
Mm-hmm.
Another part of the statue is a word, which is Sennacher, and that means incense. The word incense is part of a specific funerary inscription known as a Hetep Dinesu funerary inscription,
mm-hmm.
which means the person seated in the statue had to be someone who died. And the time period of the building, of the creating, the making of this statue is to the reign of Amenemhat III. That pharaoh, he came onto the throne the year that Jacob died, oddly enough.
Oh.
Joseph was still alive, and he would live for decades beyond this.
Right, right.
But all of that statuary is from a site called Hawara mm-hmm. in the Fayum of Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And so clearly it was during that reign and it was at the death of a person And the only person that fits is Jacob. So this has to be Jacob, not Joseph.
Wow. Is this the statue where there's evidence that the hair was red?
Yes.
Sort of the mushroom-shaped hairstyle.
Yes. And it's in an area. Weren't there small pyramids or some sort of funerary monuments?
There are scholars out there trying to say that there were pyramids, but there really weren't pyramids at Avaris.
Well, I bring that up because I know that a lot of you are familiar with some of the shows that get into this evidence, but they interpret it differently, and they're not coming at this from a biblical worldview. We really try to look through the lens of the Bible because mm-hmm. we believe the Bible is true.
Sure.
Fascinating, and an insight into the styles and the look of the Israelites back in the day. I mean, we have this image of the patriarchs all having, you know, long hair and flowing beard, mm-hmm. but this statue there, as it's been recreated with the mushroom hairstyle mm-hmm. and clean shaven, apparently,
right?
That's quite a different idea from what most of us have of what, you know, Abraham, Isaac, and...
Yes, but in the Bible, when the brothers come and they don't recognize Joseph, it's because he is clean-shaven.
Sure.
Just like the Egyptians.
In the Egyptian style,
perhaps
right.
they adopted
yeah.
that style.
Yeah, and that's what would have happened. We see this in the pottery and in the other utilitarian goods mm-hmm. that are there at the site during these Asiatic occupational phases, which I'm connecting to mm-hmm. to Hebrews. Over time, they adopt Egyptian custom, Egyptian style, Egyptian
we
tools.
We all do that.
Yeah,
you start
sure.
to soak up what the environment yeah. is. Well, we are running out of time, but next program, I want to get into something you told us yesterday, and that has to do with a female pharaoh.
Sure. Oh, yes. One of the great mysteries of Egypt that scholars have speculated about.
I know.
Why was she erased from history?
I know. I found her fascinating for a long time.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is an amazing thing, and we hope you're finding this as exciting as we do, because the new book, Origins of the Hebrews by Dr. Doug Petrovich, is going to be a valuable asset in your reference library, and it's the summary chapters, mm-hmm. chapter 9. Basically brings it all together in a way that's very readable.
Oh, exactly.
So don't be intimidated by the size of the and especially if you want to impress skeptics with the level of research that's gone into this, the level of scholarship. When we continue next week, yes, we dig into Egyptian history even further as we explore the Bible's greatest mysteries.